From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the writer as subversive. We listen to excerpts of a panel discussion of TV and movie writers recorded last month at the Writers Guild Foundation Forum. We'll hear from David Milch of NYPD Blue, Stephen Gagan of the film Traffic, and Aaron Sorkin of The West Wing. This has been one of the worst fire seasons on record. We'll talk with Peter Leschek, who has been fighting wildfires and municipal fires for 20 years. He's also written a new book on the deadliest wildfire in our nation's history. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Rising, Bruce Springsteen's new CD, inspired by September 11th. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush says he remains optimistic about the economy despite the release of disappointing growth numbers this morning. The Commerce Department said the economy grew by just 1.1% during the year's second quarter. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The government said the economy expanded by 5% during the first 3 months of this year, but then slowed considerably during the quarter that followed. The decline was attributed to a drop in consumer spending and also in business investment. President Bush downplayed the weak numbers.
I feel very optimistic about it because I look at the facts. And the facts are that inflation is low, interest rates low, productivity is high.
And the president said all that suggests the economy is moving in the right direction. The Commerce Department also said the economy shrank for the first 9 months of last year. That qualifies as an official recession under the most widely used definition. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
The Senate has approved a measure that's designed to make it easier for generic drugs to compete with name brand versions. The bill would prevent name brand manufacturers from using repeated legal maneuvers to block the approval of generic competitors after a patent has expired. It would allow only one 30-month delay. Generic drug makers have complained that name brand companies hold on to their lucrative monopolies over certain drugs by filing frivolous patents on such things as the flavor or packaging of a drug. A New Jersey man who authorities say sold fake IDs to two of the September 11th hijackers has apparently fled to Egypt. David Cruz reports from member station WBGO in Newark.
Officials expressed disappointment at the fact that Mohammed El Atris managed to slip out of the country despite being under 24-hour surveillance. Atris, an Egyptian who operated businesses in two New Jersey cities where he allegedly sold the IDs, took a flight to Egypt, according to workers at the businesses. Authorities have contacted Interpol and Egyptian officials about Atris, who allegedly sold fake ID cards to one of the hijackers on Flight 77, which hit the Pentagon, and another from Flight 11, which hit the World Trade Center. Police did arrest three employees at the stores and charged them with making and distributing fake documents. Not exactly what they expected after a four-month investigation. For NPR News, I'm David Cruz in Newark.
A bomb attack at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem has left at least seven people dead and more than 70 injured. The U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv says the attack killed an American woman and hurt other U.S. citizens. Police say the bomb went off in the cafeteria at the Frank Sinatra International Center, a meeting place for Israeli, Arab, and foreign students. Responsibility was claimed by the military wing of the Palestinian group Hamas. In stocks, the Dow gained 56 points to close at 8,736. The Nasdaq lost 15 to close at 1,328. This is NPR News. Federal prosecutors say a Russian man has been arrested in Italy on charges of trying to fix the pair's figure skating and ice dancing competitions at the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics. They charged the man as an organized crime boss who boasted that he fixed the outcome with the help of co-conspirators on the French and Russian skating federations. A Department of Interior official charged with managing the overhaul of the Indian Trust Fund has resigned. Special trustee Thomas Slonacker says he was forced to step down after publicly stating that reform efforts were not going well. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Thomas Slonecker's oversight position was created by Congress, and he was to serve as an independent voice within the Department of Indian Affairs. But in recent months, he clashed with Interior Secretary Gail Norton. Just last week, Slonecker told Congress that, despite the Interior Department's claims, there is no way to conduct a complete accounting of the mismanaged Indian Trust Fund. He said there are simply too many missing and destroyed records. Attorneys for Indians who've sued the government say $10 billion is owed to about 300,000 Native American landowners. Slonecker says his removal came yesterday afternoon during a meeting with Secretary Norton. He was handed a resignation letter and asked to sign it. Alice Norbury, NPR News, Washington.
Pope John Paul II appealed to Roman Catholics in Mexico today to help improve the lives of the country's Indian population. At a ceremony in Mexico City, the pontiff canonized the church's first Indian saint, Juan Diego. Mexico is the third and final country on the 82-year-old pontiff's North American visit. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A good script is one of the most essential ingredients for a good movie or TV show, yet we seldom hear about the industry from a writer's point of view. Every couple of years, the Writers Guild Foundation holds a conference called Words into Pictures, in which writers are joined by producers, studio executives, and marketers to discuss the issues facing the industry. Words into Pictures 2002 was held last month in Los Angeles. We're going to hear an excerpt of the panel called The Writer as Subversive. Its purpose was to address the question, in a business driven by bottom lines and global conglomerates, how can writers do personally important work that serves their conscience and pays the mortgage at the same time? The panelists we'll hear are David Milch, the co-creator and former executive producer of NYPD Blue. He also wrote for Hill Street Blues. Stephen Gagan, the screenwriter of Traffic, who used to write for NYPD Blue, and Aaron Sorkin, creator and executive producer of The West Wing. He also created Sports Night and wrote the play and screenplay A Few Good Men. The panel was moderated by Tavis Smiley, the host of the new NPR program, The Tavis Smiley Show. The discussion begins with the question, has it gotten easier or more difficult for a writer with integrity to do good work in Hollywood? We hear first from Stephen Gagan.
I'd worked in television. I knew I wanted to write about the military. I was interested in the military. I saw this thing, you know, we spend a third of every tax dollar on it, and there didn't seem to be any civilian oversight, you know, saying the military is for cleaning up after hurricanes or stopping famine in Somalia or, you know, whatever it is, and I thought that was weird, and I knew I wanted to write about it. I had one job where I wrote about it, and I wrote a script very specifically. It had multiple characters, multiple narrative. I turned it in, and I got screamed at for 2.5 hours, my favorite line was, war on trial, war is always on trial. You want to make a $60 million movie about the military in Hollywood, you better have a goddamn protagonist. And that goddamn protagonist better win, and there's an antagonist, and when he goes down in the third act, the people come out of their chairs and they cheer. If you don't have that, you don't have a f***ing movie.
Do they actually talk that way in Hollywood?
Just like that.
Just like
and,
that?
I mean, my hair was blowing back. I looked like the guy in that, you know, tape commercial. I was like, and, and I was anxious not to be fired, you know? The whole time I was getting yelled at, in my head, I'm going, I quit. And then I thought about it, and I was like, as a political animal, the job was important to me. And I went away, and in 3 weeks, I rewrote the movie with, you know, the whole time he was talking, I was like, antagonist, you know? What is this antagonist? I'd never thought about it that way. I was like, that sounds really smart. Wow. And,
better all the time.
What a good idea. So I went away after that moment, and I rewrote the thing in 3 weeks. I turned it in, and it turned out people were happy, and the movie got made. Okay. Now, cut to my next job that I'd actually been procrastinating on, which was writing Traffic, when I took this job. And I'd been terrified to write it. It was very personal to me. I had a tremendous amount of indignation over this thing called the war on drugs, and I was very angry about it. And I had a hard time starting, and it was driving me crazy. Finally, got the break, I got in, I got the entry point, and it just flew, and I had this 165-page script that had no major characters, it had 35 main characters, it had five stories, was, you know, filled with things you could never make in Hollywood. A drug movie, black drug dealers raping white girls and injecting them with heroin, and, you know, the pride of the upper middle class being seduced into this world. And I turned it into Steven Soderbergh, and I dropped it on his porch. And I didn't hear from him for a couple days. I got anxious. I called him up, and he's a very soft-spoken person. And he goes, "Hello?" I said, "Hey, Steven, it's Steve Gagan." He goes, "Oh, hey." I was like, "Did you get the script?" Yeah, I got it. "Did you read it?" Yeah, I read it. "What'd you think of it?" I liked it, it's good. I mean, there's like a 30-second silence now. I don't know what to say. And he says, "No, I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it as my next movie." And at that point, it began a process that was totally different than any process I'd ever been in Hollywood and before or after, which was he was able, due to the success of his career at that point, to really build a wall. And we had no studio, and nobody put any notes in. It was just literally the two of us pleasing ourselves. And the movie, we finally had a studio. We funded pre-production out of our own pockets, and we had a studio 3 weeks before we started shooting. In this instance, it felt like the easiest thing in the world. It was like falling downhill. All the ideas he had made the script better. I mean, and one of the first ideas was, we can't get a movie star because there's nobody that has a big enough role. And that made perfect sense to me. And so I rewrote the entire role for Michael Douglas. That's just pragmatics. But whether it's easier in the past or easier now, I don't know. This feels like a peculiar experience. But yet the fact that type of peculiar experience can happen, and it only happened 2 years ago, this is not the distant past, I think it's very encouraging.
David, I'll come to you first since you raised this. It is a business, and a business that is changing dramatically. Multinational companies, conglomerates, vertical integration. Seems to me, I know in what I do, that makes everything much more difficult. But I'm not in the business that you all are in. Talk to me about how the way this industry is changing, given the things I just mentioned, how that impacts a writer, and whether or not that makes it more difficult or easy to do what writers do.
It makes it a lot more difficult. I'll tell you that I left NYPD Blue a couple years ago, and I was deciding where I was going to work next. And I had a couple of negatives. I met with some people. I said, "Well, this guy I will not work for, and this network I will not work for." I made my arrangements, and within 2 weeks, I was working for that guy at that network. Because, you know, they keep swallowing each other up so fast. And it's important to understand that at its heart, this is a business whose predicate is most essentially antagonistic to creativity. What they want is something predictable. Having said that, it's possible to do something which looks predictable, which is in fact creative. Steve, because of a concatenation of circumstances, is able to do something which a little while ago people said, it's impossible. You don't have an antagonist. You don't have a sympathetic figure. But because now they are able to say, well, there's Steve Soderbergh. We don't know what he does, but he's bringing it in. He's bringing it in. Maybe Steve, when the black guy gets the white girl, is he a light-skinned black guy? Can we at least do that? Hey, I give to the parties. I give to the Democratic Party, but if we could have a light-skinned, high yellow guy, how about that? You know, and you just, okay.
That's David Milch. We'll hear more of the Writers Guild Foundation panel discussion, The Writer as Subversive, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the panel discussion, The Writer as Subversive, recorded in June at the Writers Guild Foundation's conference, Words into Pictures. The panelists we're hearing from are David Milch, co-creator of NYPD Blue, Stephen Gagan, screenwriter of Traffic and former writer for NYPD Blue, and Aaron Sorkin, creator of The West Wing. The moderator is Tavis Smiley, host of NPR's new program, The Tavis Smiley Show. They've been discussing the creative process behind scripts that turned out to be controversial. Here, Gagan is talking about working with Milch on NYPD Blue.
When we shared the Emmy, I'd worked on a script for him out of a story that he'd come up with. I wrote, and it had come out a certain way, and it wasn't very good. And David took it, and I got to sit next to him in this little room, and I watched him do this thing. It was an episode of NYPD Blue where Sipowicz had to confront the fact that he was a racist, and it had a pretty famous scene at the end where he's in the locker room with Jimmy Smits, and he's trying to justify his own racism, and he tells this very long story about watching his dad come back from Vietnam, and watching his dad getting his eye, coming back from Vietnam, watching his dad get his eye knocked out with a ball-peen hammer, just trying to read a gas meter in a black neighborhood. I was there when David created that. He didn't know what he was going to write. He was just sitting there. He got in some groove, and he just dictated it. And it came out in a rush. It won the Emmy for us as writers. It won the Emmy for the actor. It won the Emmy for the director. And he was, I mean, you should have seen him. He was running around the Bochco building. He was just like, my God, and because we all knew what had happened. What he'd done, though, was write something very subtle and very beautiful about racism in America. He didn't set out to say, I'm going to make some statement about racism. I mean, it just happened. I watched it. And yet it was very subtle, and it was beautiful. And everybody, a lot of people in this country, like 30 million Americans at that time, really related to Sipowicz. Sipowicz was a racist, but they also related to him. And here he is trying to justify it in the baldest, ugliest way. You know, it was a beautiful thing, and it didn't seem planned, necessarily.
If I may, just to let you know, this is not... ours is not a business which demands honor, but it does not absolutely preclude honor. And one of the things that's so exciting about being in it is after I...
David, you ought to be an ambassador. You really
thank
get it.
You know. But what I want to say is 2 years later, I woke up one morning and I said, my God, that story was a lie. Now, when I wrote it, I knew that story was true. And I suddenly realized that the truth was Sipowicz's father was a drunk. He'd been fired for not reading the meters. He came home. He said, these c***ers, they want me to go read these niggers' meters? I'll go out. I'll read these f***ing niggers' meters at 10 o'clock at night. And he kicked the black man's door down. And the man put a hammer in his eye, protecting his house. Now, I swear to you that I had no idea that when I wrote the first scene, that the second scene was true. But I suddenly realized that's how a son protects his image of his father. And the fact that we continue to show up every week and stay available, sometimes we're going to do calmer, but if you keep showing up and you try to stay true to what Henry James called the obstinate finality and artistic sensibility, then sometimes you get lucky.
All right, an hour and 7 minutes in this conversation, the word nigger finally came up, and so...
I apologize for
you. I'm not ready to have this race question and conversation. If in fact, this business, again, is taking risk, it seems to me that one of the areas where we're not taking risk is on the question of diversity, on the issue of diversity. And I really shouldn't even phrase it that way because it ought not to be a risk. It ought not to be a risk to show on television and on the big screen the breadth and depth of what America really is. It ought not to be a risk, a quantum leap, to have what we see reflect what America is. And yet this industry, quite frankly, sucks and stinks when it comes to valuing diversity. I'm not just talking about color, I'm talking about gender as well. We do a horrible job, it seems to me, in this business. Everybody gives lip service to this, and with all due respect to the Guild, even when we have these conversations, save the one Negro in the middle moderating the conversation, all of the diversity panel was, I mean, the diversity thing, I'm told, was yesterday. I mean, was it yesterday? They had a diversity panel yesterday. So apparently all the Negroes were on that panel yesterday, and we can't find one black writer to be on this panel today. Having said that, with all due respect to the Guild, what is the problem to this day? We live now, and we've had this debate for years. I'm not blaming the Guild for this. This is an age-old question. But it seems to me that we now live in the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America ever. And yet we keep coming back to this ridiculous conversation about why we cannot see, not just on in front of the camera, characters that reflect the breadth and depth of diversity in this country, but indeed the writing staffs that you represent stink, quite frankly, in terms of diversity when it comes to people of color and women. What are we going to do about that, and what is the problem here, gentlemen, ladies?
What do you think the problem is?
Yeah. I think the problem is, that, well, this ain't my panel. You don't want to hear that.
Yeah, I do.
No,
yeah,
no.
I do. You're the only Negro here.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. That's a good one. In that case, let me represent all the Negroes in America, then, if I might. I think, you know, I am not so it's one of two things, and perhaps a combination of both. It is ignorance or it is arrogance. It seems to me, though, that the ignorance argument starts to, you know, speaking of one foot, flying over the cuckoo's nest, this ignorance argument is flown. I mean, that dog just won't hunt anymore. So let's pass on the ignorance argument, which leaves me with one thing left, David, arrogance. It is the pomposity and the arrogance of the folk who write in this business who don't feel compelled on any level to include people of color in these scripts.
Well,
that's just my take on it, but you guys do this, not me.
Yeah, I disagree.
All right, Aaron.
Well, first of all, you're talking about two different things. You're talking about characters in the script, but you also talk about behind the
characters,
camera.
Characters, issues, behind the camera, all of the above. Yeah. The track record stinks either way, Aaron.
Yeah, I don't think so. In terms of behind the camera for staffing positions, Davis, we hunt high and low. For people of color.
Aaron, before you go there, with all due respect, please don't give me the argument you can't find no qualified people of color. Please don't say that. Please don't say that.
I'm not talking about qualified people of color. I don't believe in tokenism. It's not important to me to fill two of these slots with people of color. I hire the very best people that I can.
Right.
In terms of casting the show, from which we took a certain amount of heat, at the time we couldn't really say which was true, which was that's simply for every role. For every single role, including and especially the character of the president.
Right.
We read and, in fact, offered the role to both men and women of color. First person we offered the character of the president to was Sidney Poitier. In the case of Sidney Poitier, he passed. In the case of other situations, you know, we cast the actor who came in and read the best. We're absolutely open. To multi-ethnic, multi-racial casting. It was never a question in our mind. We would have been happier to have done it because we wouldn't have, frankly, been confronted with this. But in the end, I have to tell you something. In a panel that's talking about integrity, we truly did stay true to our conscience. We cast the actors that we wanted in the parts. And as a result of having cast seven of the eight principal cast as white, we then go out of our way week after week after week after week to make sure that the secretary of this and the chairman of that and the senator from here does represent a cross-section of America.
Let me ask this question, David, before you respond. Sure. Let me ask this question, and anybody, feel free to respond to this. Let's assume for the moment that I'm right about this, because I am right about this, that this industry has a long way to go in front of and behind the camera in terms of appreciating diversity. But for the purposes of our conversation today, we're talking about writers. How do we challenge those persons in this room, those on this panel, who are doing the writing? Whether, you know, I'm not asking for token positions, but it seems to me you got to do one of two things. You either got to hire more people of color who can write expressly and uniquely from a colored perspective, so to speak, or you got to challenge the folk who write for the West Wing and everybody else in here who writes to have a more wholesome and a more universal view of the world that we live in. How do we challenge those folks who do the writing, who are not persons of color, to be more fair in their writing?
That's wonderful.
Is that a legitimate question?
Yeah, it's a legitimate right. question, and I would say a couple of things. The first thing I would do is to address the people of color, because the people who make the decisions are not going to give you a fair shot. So that's the first thing to understand. And the certainty that you have that they're not going to give you a fair shot is all of their good intentions. Because the moment you start talking about good intentions and reaching out and I've tried to make myself available and stuff, that's somebody who is justifying a preconception about the nature of reality. Any writer
comes to you by ones. He doesn't come to you, or she doesn't come to you as a black person or a white person. Comes to you as a writer. And my prejudice is to respond to the person with whose lexicon I am most familiar. Now, I cop to this. I taught a seminar. I try to be available as a teacher every year. I try to be, anybody can come to those seminars. So someone asked me a question, well, how can you write a racist character? I said, because I'm a racist. Anybody here who has not had racist feelings, it's the nature of the beast. Freud wrote about the narcissism of perceived difference. It's the way that we function. We see ourselves and we see others. Okay, so that's the most obvious kind of statement. Now, a lot of people in that audience were taping the conversation, and some of them sent it to newspapers. I am a racist, confesses creator of NYPD Blue, headline in the Washington Post. Now, there was one guy who wrote me a letter, and he said, congratulations on guaranteeing the future employment of so many mediocre white motherfuckers. And I met with him. And he won an Emmy for us, and he just won an Emmy for himself for the series The Corner, and he's doing just fine. Now, the challenge that I would put is to stop thinking to writers of color is it's not a just environment. Part of the bullshit that we use to keep the things the way they are is to pretend that it is just. It's not just, because I don't respond with the same open heart to people who seem to me to be different. That's the way that human beings are. And not only do I not respond the same way, but I will develop a whole mythology to justify the fact that I don't respond the same way until an individual shows me otherwise. And we're going to get there by ones. And what my teacher told me was the secret subject of any story worth telling is time. And it's going to take time. And the only way it's going to happen is not through collective programs. It's going to happen through people not internalizing a sense of grievance, not therefore doing, well, here's commerce and here's conscience, and if I'm going to succeed as a writer of color, I have to subordinate conscience and do commerce. Forget it. Forget it. Stay with your story. And come with your story, and then hope you get lucky, as Mr. Goldman said. Well, just hope you get lucky, because there's no guarantee anybody gets lucky. I spent 20 years in a room, and I was just as good a writer as I am now, and I couldn't get out of my own way, and then I got lucky.
That was an excerpt from the Writer as Subversive panel from the Writers Guild Foundation conference recorded last month in Los Angeles. Thanks to all the panel participants and the foundation for making this broadcast possible. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Medicine Wheel Garden, Creating Sacred Space for Healing, Celebration, and Tranquility by E. Barry Kavash. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is one of the worst fire seasons on record. Coming up, we talk with veteran firefighter Peter Leschek about his experiences with wildfires and about his new book, which describes the deadliest wildfire in American history. And Ken Tucker reviews The Rising, Bruce Springsteen's new CD, in response to September 11th. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This has been a devastating fire season. Wildfires have consumed millions of acres across the West. 15 firefighters have died so far this summer. There have been 2 fatal helicopter crashes in a wildfire north of Denver. My guest, Peter Leschek, runs a helicopter crew which is dispatched to states throughout the West. They fly to fires, where Leschek sizes them up and makes tactical decisions. They also land close to the fire and fight it on the ground. Leschek lives in Minnesota and has been fighting wildfires and municipal fires for 20 years. He's also the author of a new book about the deadliest wildfire in North American history, which consumed the town of Peshtigo, Wisconsin in 1871. His book is called Ghosts of the Fireground. There's controversy surrounding which forest fires should be fought and which should be allowed to burn. Leschek says a significant date in the history of that controversy is the summer of 1910.
During that summer, particularly in the Northern Rockies in Idaho and Montana, there were a series of very large and catastrophic forest fires. 78 firefighters were killed that year. There were small little mining and lumbering towns in the Northern Rockies that were basically erased. And in the wake of that season, the federal government essentially declared war on wildfire and actually called it evil, quote-unquote evil. And over the next few generations, there was a huge commitment made in money, manpower, and equipment to extirpate fire from the forest and from the wildlands, you know, the rangelands, the brushlands. And we were successful to a fault with the aid of aircraft and other emerging technologies. We did way too good a job.
Has it become more difficult to let fires burn now that I think more people have moved into the forest, you know, built like lovely homes or little cabins in places where fires might burn? So you have people in jeopardy in a way that they might not have been in jeopardy with wildfires before.
Oh, absolutely. I remember in particular, even over the course of my career, the last 20 years or so, I've noticed a huge increase in homes out there where you never used to see them. I was surprised back in the mid-90s. We went to a fire on the Salmon River Breaks. You know, if you like rattlesnakes in 110 degrees, the breaks is for you. But now, suddenly, there were homes there. And we had a fire approaching those homes, and we loaded one of our operations chiefs on the helicopter, and he basically did structure triage from the air. This house is a loser. This one we might be able to save it. This one's a loser, and so on. Because especially in volatile fuels on steep slopes, sometimes there's nothing that can be done. And obviously, if human life is involved, if someone happens to be in that house, you know, you're going to make the ultimate effort.
Has that caused some difficult moments for you? Have you been in the position of risking your life to save a home, not a life, but a home in the forest?
Well, I've certainly taken a lot of punishment trying to save homes. You know, whether my life was actually in jeopardy, you know, those things on the fire ground, you usually don't know that till it's too late. But I have certainly taken a lot more smoke and heat and pain, you know, attempting to save a structure. And sure, it's a great feeling when you save somebody's home. But on the other hand, sometimes you just sort of groan. It's like, why did they build there? I mean, you know, what were they thinking? This is not going to work.
Where's your home?
It's in Fuel.
Is it?
It is. I live in the woods. And to be quite honest with you, when I do a lot of fire instructing, I teach one class called Tactics in the Rural-Urban Interface. That's what we call Homes and Fuel. And I needed some bad examples, so I took photographs of my own house.
And why is your house such a bad example?
Well, I don't have enough defensible space, as we call it. I did make one huge improvement, however. We did put a metal roof on this year, and studies have shown both in Southern California and in Australia that the most popular way for a residence to ignite is not direct flame impingement on the wall, but flying embers landing on a combustible roof. So I've made some improvements, but you know, I also understand that if this place burns down, it's you know, it's no fault but my own.
Your new book, Ghosts of the Fireground, is partially a memoir, and it's partially a look at a fire in the summer of 1871. and a Catholic priest, Reverend Peter Pernin, who survived this fire and kept a journal of what happened. Tell us what makes this fire so unique.
Well, it's really an undertold story, and it's one reason I wanted to write the book. You know, on October 8th, 1871, the Peshtigo Fire, in the span of a few hours, burned over 1.2 million acres, which is almost inconceivable. To put it into perspective, that was about the acreage of all of the Yellowstone fires combined in 1988, and that happened over the course of 3 or 4 months. And in comparison, this fire was virtually instantaneous. It killed 1,200 to 1,500 people. It was the deadliest wildfire in North American history. And if this happened today, it would be planet-wide news. It would be story number one. But most Americans, very strangely, have never even heard of it, unless you grew up in Wisconsin and you got this as part of the state history and lore. Most people never heard of it, and this was because at the very same hour and day, the Great Chicago Fire ignited, the one supposedly started by Mrs. O'Leary's cow. And although 300 people perished in Chicago, which of course is not trivial, Peshtigo dwarfed this. It was about 200 miles to the north, a small community near Green Bay, and it was essentially erased with most of the people who had lived there. And I discovered the account, or came across the published account of Father Peter Pernin, this Catholic priest. And as I read this, and understand it was a very almost self-effacing account. He did not bill himself as a great hero or anything of the sort. But as I read through this, especially filtering it through my own experiences with fire, I realized that this man had done an incredible, incredible thing, and that his survival was just astounding.
How did Father Peter Pernin manage to survive this fire?
What he did, he decided that he needed to save the appliances of the church, his tools, so to speak, the tabernacle, the chalice, the paten. And although he later acknowledged that these were merely physical objects and they could be replaced, he also understood that he had invested them with huge, with very profound sacred symbolism. And so he wanted to save these. And so he tried, he could see the fire coming. And actually, he was one of the few people who understood what was going on. He had had, he thought that his fellow citizens had not been afraid enough in the weeks preceding. In any case, he tries to hook his horse to his buggy to transport these items to the river, and he knows that's the only hope. Other people are going away from the river to certain death. He's keeping his head about himself. But his horse simply, the horse is panic-stricken. The horse goes crazy. He later finds his horse in a very poignant moment burned to death. So he puts these appliances in the buggy and he acts as his own horse and drags them down to the river. He's stumbling over the bodies of people who have already died. He sees people actually, sees their clothing burst into flame and they become human torches. He finally makes it to the river and he shoves this buggy into the water, hoping to save the buggy and its contents. And amazingly enough, when he gets there, he sees several dozen people are lined up on the riverbank, and they're just paralyzed. You have to understand at this point, these people are in the middle of a vortex of fire, a hurricane of fire. All they can see all around and above them are flames. And one of these people later tells the priest that they assumed it was the end of the world. This was the day of wrath, that this was the apocalypse. And ironically enough, in just this fantastic moment, the priest, whom you would assume would be a subscriber to this particular theory, he will have none of it. And he pushes two people into the river, and one of them comes clambering out, complaining that he's wet, of all things. And the priest drags him back in. And when he does this, all of the other people lined up on the bank who had simply been waiting for God to kill them now plunge into the river, and it was a fantastic moment, and thus he managed to save the lives of these people, and they began to cluster around him in the river, realizing that here was the only person that they could see who was still thinking, who was still rational, who wasn't going insane with terror.
What were some of the lasting physical after effects of the fire on the survivors?
The short-term effects are very interesting. They spend all night in the river. They go in, I don't remember the exact time now, but they spend about 9 hours in the river while this town is just simply vaporized around them. And of course, some people die in the river. It's not a guaranteed safe haven. In the morning, the priest is one of the first to try to crawl out. And at about 3 in the morning, he makes his first attempt. But the back of his vestments burst into flame on the riverbank, and so he is forced back into the river. But by morning, the priest and several other people are completely blind. And whether this was radiant heat burns to the eyes or a kind of psychological anopia, they just didn't want to see anymore. Several of them are blind, and the priest has to be led around by the hand for a couple of days before his sight returns. Several people did go mad. They went insane. The terror of this catastrophe was too much for them.
My guest is veteran firefighter Peter Leschek. He's the author of the new book, Ghosts of the Fire Ground. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Leschek. He's a longtime firefighter and the author of the new book, Ghosts of the Fire Ground. Now, you started as a volunteer firefighter in a small town. You became the fire chief, and you had so many stress symptoms from being the fire chief. You went to the doctor. Then you discovered wildfire fighting and felt that that was actually your calling. Why was it more exciting than fighting fires in a small town?
Well, I still do the small town thing, and the wildland. I think I am more attracted to it because I grew up outdoors. I love the wildlands of the nation. I love climbing the mountains and wading through the bogs, and to a certain extent being eaten by the mosquitoes. I mean, it's just something that I've always bonded with and just really enjoy. And I consider my municipal firefighting as duty. I don't care if I ever go to another structure fire and see some homeowner screaming and crying and all the rest of it. That's duty. I will continue to do it. But for me, the joy where I really belong, I think, is in that wildland setting. It's where I feel most alive.
You've said that you think the structure fires in small towns are much more dangerous than the big wildfires in the forest. Can you explain that?
Well, when you even if it's a simple residence, I mean, we don't have to talk the Twin Towers, we don't have to talk skyscrapers and mega malls burning. Even if you have a simple single family dwelling, especially in this day and age, for one thing, it's filled with hazardous waste. Look under your kitchen sink. You have all of these toxic chemicals that can put out especially noxious fumes and smoke when they burn. Most modern homes are filled with plastics, and when plastics burn, they generate intense amounts of heat, and they also generate a lot of hydrogen cyanide gas, which is the same gas that's used to execute people in the gas chamber. There's the potential for explosion. There's always the potential that someone is inside that home, and therefore you have no option but to take the ultimate risk, to risk your life to save them. It is your only option. Being inside of a burning building is being in the most hazardous locale on the planet, and it happens hundreds of times every day across this country.
What's the worst injuries you sustained fighting fires?
I have had knee surgery and back surgery, and, those were the biggies. Minor burns, too many bruises and small cuts to even mention or even think about. But yeah, I've had surgery as a result of it, and you know, I joke with my crew that I'm only one mistake away from retirement. I can only be a klutz one more time, and it's all over.
Are you okay living in pain? Do you have pain as a result of earlier injuries, and you can handle that okay?
I have not had a pain-free day in probably 15 years, but it's the kind of pain that is manageable with exercise, with over-the-counter drugs. Occasionally, I get a prescription for an anti-inflammatory that I keep in my pack, especially when I get in mountainous terrain. Climbing hills is great, but the down slope's a killer on an ankle that I also had surgery on at one time. And so I just pack a good painkiller that will not make me drowsy and take it from there.
On your dust jacket author photo for your new book, Ghosts of the Fireground, you're in the photo in the woods with a plaid flannel shirt, and your arm is around your dog, who's a very handsome,
Isn't he? Isn't he great?
Yeah. Tell me something about your dog.
Well, unfortunately, this particular guy is dead right now. But he was a total mutt, and the no one was ever able to figure out exactly what his lineage was, but he was an extremely intelligent dog, and I love that photograph because I think you can see it in his face.
It looks like he has like a dog with an inner life.
this dog was spooky. I always figured that his vocabulary of the English language was about at least 150 words, and that he was constantly eavesdropping on our conversations. But yeah, you look at him, and you know, you expect a new cosmological theory to come out of that head.
Did he connect with fires at all? Did you meet him through a fire or anything like that?
No. He just appeared one day. My brother was living in a city at the time. Bought this dog and thought he was going to keep it in an apartment, and decided that he would drop the dog off with us. And he said, "Oh, you know, I've already named it." I said, "Oh, what's that?" He said, "Well, its name is Boldarev." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, it's a Czechoslovakian hockey player." I said, "Well, this is wonderful." And so his nickname was always the Reverend, and we considered him smart enough to be the Reverend.
Do you expect to be fighting more fires through the summer?
Absolutely. I am on a few days off here, which, you know, allows me the pleasure to talk with you, because I had gone like 28 in a row, so I had to take some time off. My last day of work. You know, we went to two fires that day here in northeastern Minnesota, toward the middle of July, and I fully expect to be on fires again. If not here, we will head somewhere else. It's almost a given. A Helitech crew is often a highly prized resource. I am very fortunate to have one of the best Helitech crews east of the Rockies, and we will get sucked in somewhere sooner or later.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you good luck fighting fires.
Well, thank you, Terry. It was my pleasure.
Peter Leschek is a firefighter and author of the new book, Ghosts of the Fireground. He and his helicopter crew are currently in Minnesota waiting to be dispatched. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Bruce Springsteen's new CD, recorded in response to September 11th. This is Fresh Air. Bruce Springsteen has just released The Rising. It's the first time since the late 80s that he's recorded a full album with his E Street Band. In August, Springsteen and his group will begin a nationwide tour, and this Thursday and Friday they'll perform on Late Night with David Letterman. Rakruta Ken Tucker says that this burst of activity probably has a lot to do with the messages Springsteen wants to deliver on the rising.
Of all the rock stars who might feel compelled to comment in some way on the terrorist attacks of September 11th, Bruce Springsteen is probably the one big one who could be expected to do it with some eloquence, some restraint, avoiding charges of sentimentality or exploitation. And indeed, this new album, The Rising, is steeped in the feelings of shock, numbness, confusion, and a frustration that avoids anger in favor of emotional complexity. At least four songs on The Rising address September 11th with varying degrees of explicitness, and as you might expect, the results are mixed. The best of them is Empty Sky, written from the point of view of a woman who wakes every morning only to remember that someone is missing from her life.
I woke up this morning, I could barely breathe, just an empty.
This album represents the first time Springsteen hasn't used his longtime manager John Landau and engineer Chuck Plotkin to produce his songs. Instead, he's turned to Brendan O'Brien, who's worked with bands as various as Pearl Jam and Korn. O'Brien opens up Springsteen's melodies, clearing a path so he doesn't have to shout, making way for the E Street Band's guitars to surge as powerfully as its keyboards, and providing crisp showcases for rhythms that are new to Springsteen's music, such as the sinuous twists of The Fuse.
Down at the courthouse, they're ringing the flag down, down. Long black line of cars sneaking slow through town. Richie's snapping on the line. With this ring, will you be mine? The fuse is burning. Shut out the light. The fuse is burning. Come on, let me do your ride.
The most curious thing about this collection is that, with all its careful thinking and craft, Springsteen's confidence as a 52-year-old rock and roller doesn't extend to what would be a logical abandonment of the bombastic party music that characterized his youthful work. In other words, there are a few clunkers, like the banal Mary's Place, which seems to exist primarily as a tune designed to get even the stodgiest fogey out of his seat during Springsteen's upcoming tour. Party music like Mary's Place is, of course, one element of Springsteen's ongoing chronicle of the ways people find simple yet profound pleasure in rock and roll. But throughout this album, Springsteen's best acknowledgement of the small details of everyday life can be found elsewhere. It's often said that Springsteen ennobles the common man in his music, but I think that's utterly wrong. If he tried to do that, he'd sound false and phony. Instead, Springsteen's salient talent lies in the way he weds somber melodies to closely observed, often elliptically poetic details. It's not some idealization of working-class life that makes a song like You're Missing so effective. It's the meticulous assembling of what a room looks like, of how voices sound in a house, that makes him a musician who repays close attention.
Shirts in the closet, shoes in the hall, mama's in the kitchen, baby and all. Jackets on the chair, papers on the doorstep, but you're not there. Everything is everything. Everything is everything, but you're missing.
By all means, go see the Boss gallop around the stage with saxophonist Clarence Clemons and relive your youth this summer. But also listen to The Rising Alone. For alone is the way Springsteen sounds here, even when he's surrounded by his band, his friends, his wife. He's created music that speaks directly to a listener one-on-one, trying to jumpstart a dialogue whose response may answer some of the hard questions he's asking.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Bruce Springsteen's new CD, The Rising. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. Can't feel nothing but this chain that grinds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone. On my shoulder, half mile of line. Come on up for the rising. Come on up.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at VermontVacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sam Mendes, director of the film Road to Perdition. And we meet Max Allen Collins, the author of the graphic novel that the movie is based on. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.